You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. A UN special report on the impacts of climate change on the ocean sparked dire headlines like, the world's oceans are in danger and we're all in big trouble. While true, those headlines and that report don't tell the whole story. A second report on oceans and climate change released that same week portrayed the ocean as not only a victim of climate change, but also an important part of the solution. According to that report, ocean-based climate action could do as much to reduce global carbon emissions as eliminating all coal-fired power plants currently on Earth. Joining me now to explore both sides of the ocean climate coin is Rick Murray. He's Deputy Director and Vice President for Research at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Rick, these reports from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, are not new science in the sense that they didn't go out and do new experiments, gather new data. What they're doing is taking all of the existing science that's out there and published and pulling it together, creating a new synthesis. So what new understanding came out of that exercise this time around while looking specifically at the impacts of climate change on the oceans?
I think one of the greatest values of these reports is that they show the breadth and, no pun intended, but the depth of the impact on the oceans. They catalog, as you noted, the results from hundreds of scientists from all over the world on peer-reviewed publications, but they're looking at the biology, the chemistry, the physical behavior of the ocean, and so on. So what's the real value here of this is it's showing these changes that are throughout. Some of us might be more experienced in sea level rise personally. Some of us might be more affected by changes in the commercial fishing. But these reports really put it all in one place.
And what we heard coming out of this report was that the changes are more extreme. They're happening more quickly than we perhaps had recognized. Can you give us one concrete example, maybe sea level rise projections? How much of those changed since the last time that this international group of scientists looked at what we knew about sea level rise?
Overall, our understanding of sea level rise in the last 5 to 8 years has definitely shown that the rates are increasing. But what we also get a better feeling on from these reports are sort of the local variability. Areas of around the world where sea level rise might be going faster than the global average, other areas where it may be going more slowly. So the degree of specificity of these reports is very important and extremely helpful as we try to plan for our changing future.
When we think about the impacts of climate change on the ocean, how much of it is worrying about ocean ecosystems for the sake of ocean ecosystems and ocean life, and how much of it is worrying about how those ocean changes will impact human life?
Actually, I think those are indistinguishable because as ecosystems change, they're going to change human life because certain plankton ecosystems are contributing to the amount and the rate of change of oxygen in our atmosphere over different time frames. Changes in the marine ecosystems certainly are affecting commercial fishing. There's changes that are going on, and one could make a very reasonable argument that all of them affect human civilization because we are all passengers on the same planet together.
Rick Murray, some of the findings in this most recent report on oceans and climate change are things like, as we've mentioned, more rapid sea level rise, as much as a 25% decline in sustainable fishery yields by the end of the century. Some pretty dramatic changes. Are these changes inevitable at this point?
Some are probably inevitable. Unfortunately, I think sea level is certainly going to be rising. And there's other than fundamentally combating global warming and climate change by decreasing the amount of ice melting, there's not a lot we can do about global sea level rise, certainly over, say, the next decade, other than changing the system, which we absolutely, in my opinion, should start doing. Other systems, other aspects of this are more easy to affect in terms of again, you drew the attention to commercial fishing. We can put in place management practices for fishing, which we've done quite a lot of, but we can do more. We can certainly change the amount of nutrients that we put into coastal waters by regulating more securely septic systems in coastal communities. So there's a lot that we can do to help mitigate and manage these changes that are coming.
So there are actions we can take that will make the impacts of climate change less severe, but at the heart of it, a lot of this is about just reducing global carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere to limit the scope of climate change itself. And Rick Murray, there was a second report that came out, I think just a day after this report, from a different UN group, looking at how ocean-based climate action could be a major part of the solution of reducing global carbon emissions. One of the main things, they gave five broad categories of action, and one of them was renewable energy. In order for ocean-based renewable energy, whether that's offshore wind or tidal or wave energy, to really have a major impact, how much of the ocean are we looking at developing?
I'm not sure in terms of square miles or square acreage or square kilometers that we would need to be developing, but certainly offshore wind has great potential for being a significant contributor to our energy system. And in one of the sort of ironies or fortunate aspects of this whole conversation is the oil and gas industry, energy companies, have a lot of experience in putting big steel infrastructure out on the near continental shelf with all their history for drilling for oil. So energy companies, as they evolve to include more and more offshore wind in their portfolio, they are actually somewhat uniquely positioned in terms of their engineering prowess to make a significant contribution to this.
In addition to the ocean being a place where low-carbon energy production could be cited, there were a couple of categories of action that were aimed at actually getting the ocean to suck up more of the carbon dioxide that is in the atmosphere. And already we know that the ocean has sucked up something like, what, a quarter to a third of human-produced carbon emissions. Just, you know, as ocean plants grow, they're sucking in carbon dioxide. How could we enhance the amount of carbon dioxide that the ocean takes up?
Well, there's certain mechanisms by which, you know, various groups or individuals have proposed adding more nutrients, in particular iron, into areas that might stimulate biological productivity that would, in essence, you have more plant life, more plankton plants growing in the ocean that would remove CO2 and would take it down to the deep sea. There's a lot of work that would need to be done before we could ever conceive of actually doing such a thing. But there are other ways that the ocean can be, or oceanic areas could be used. For example, some other folks have proposed carbon capture. So you would have carbon being emitted by coal plants, instead of just going up into the atmosphere, it would be captured into pipelines that could then be piped out and perhaps buried beneath the seafloor. So again, I go back to the fact that it's one planet, and the ocean is 70% of that planet's surface. It's the only planet we know on which we can live. And probably because it's a global problem, there are likely going to be global solutions.
This report did say that those kinds of deep ocean carbon storage solutions, more carbon going down to the deep ocean, those are, as you said, going to take a lot of work. They're probably the least certain of any of the possible solutions, but that right around the edges of the ocean, we have opportunities for a huge amount of carbon storage in ecosystems like mangroves and wetlands, that just conserving and perhaps rebuilding some of those could make a really huge impact.
That's entirely correct. We're all familiar with tropical rainforests, and we understand how plant growth on land, trees and so on, can certainly take sequester atmospheric carbon dioxide. But you're absolutely correct, Heather, in that the near shore, the marshes, the wetlands, those are very, very dense areas of growth. And reducing the decline of those and reestablishing environments where those can flourish, on a one-off basis, not so much. But if that ends up being a widespread change or process that we can implement, that would certainly help. There's no magic bullet here. There's not one thing we're going to be able to do that's going to, you know, solve the whole host of problems. And so it's going to take a lot of different actions. Any one alone won't do it, but collectively, we might be able to start mitigating the situation. I'd also like to, you know, make a push for the fact that there's a lot we don't know. And not knowing something presents a challenge, but it's an opportunity for us to learn more so we can make better decisions, and the policymakers who are making these decisions can have a more informed understanding of, okay, should we put more into marine protected areas? You know, how much can they do? What's the uncertainty in that?
Rick Murray, it strikes me that there are these two separate reports that came out within days of each other, one looking at the impacts of climate change on the ocean, one looking at the ocean's ability to impact, to mitigate climate change. Where's the connection between those two? I mean, one of these reports is saying that we could see a 25% decline in sustainable fishery yields by the end of the century and that that threatens food stability. The other one is saying part of the solution to climate change would be switching to lower carbon diets and eating more seafood. But those two don't seem to necessarily connect. How do we close this loop looking at the ocean and I guess the whole planet holistically as both part of the problem and part of the solution?
Well, that's the challenge, isn't it? And I'm not saying that to be evasive, but it could mean that we do different types of fishing. Essentially, commercial fishing now is dominated by fishing in the wild. Folks go out and they get fish that are swimming around in the wild as opposed to aquaculture. So maybe if we can be increasing aquaculture in some ways, that could be a contribution. So there's, and I'm not saying it necessarily is, but I'm also not necessarily saying it is not. I think the two reports are actually presenting the same, different sides of the same coin, because again, it's all happening in the same place and it's all affecting our same atmosphere.
Rick Murray is Deputy Director and Vice President for Research at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Up next, why an online census in 2020 is potentially bad news for Native American communities living on tribal lands. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.